Hi, everybody. I'm Beauty Confredos, and I am now in the Ask Beauty Show zone here on the Progressive Radio Network. You know, I say this every week, but it really is amazing that when I hear the music, I am completely catapulted into a really wonderful, safe, motivating kind of space, regardless of what has happened or what has not happened in the previous few hours. And I think that all of us, we need to find something. Maybe it's not a producer on PRN to play some interesting music, but whether or not it is music or meditation. And I think maybe that's really the goal for all of us, to find something in our life or some things in our life that, regardless of what is going on, that we can find a way to experience some peace so that we can actually be present. And I'm actually amazed by the music choice, because I'm not the most spiritual person in the world. And people who know me, they know that I'm sensitive and I'm kind, but I'm also very, very bottom line. And I had a very chaotic kind of a morning. I had some patients. I'm dealing with a 15-year-old boy who's been expressing a lot of suicidal thoughts and has made a number of gestures. So that I was very, very preoccupied. And I was sitting in my office here on the Upper West Side here in New York City and wondering, am I going to be able to really center myself so that I can do the show in a really coherent way? And the music does it for me. So let's think about some of the things that you may need to explore for yourself that will also do it for you, so that you can become present, at least for a period of time, and that you're going to then be able to just put away some of the angst and some of the stress that typically you're really having to deal with. So anyways, as you all know by now, and I really can't believe that it's the end of December and that there are just two more Ask Beauty shows that I'm going to be hosting in 2021. And of course, you all know, you've been listening to me since 2013. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm also a sex therapist, and I'm the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever: Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this is a book for anybody who's really serious. And I think that serious is the key word in doing a great assessment about who we allow into our lives. Now, the book, of course, initially was written to help people assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you when it comes to love and romance before committing to any serious relationship. You know, but when I think about it, I was talking to a patient of mine yesterday who's actually just moved to Florida. And she's been meeting all kinds of people, and she's been calling me, and she's been telling me how excited she is about all the wonderful people, the trustworthy people that she has been meeting. Now, she's only met them a couple of times, and I reminded her, you know, again, how careful. You don't want to be paranoid about any of this, but how careful we really do need to be who we let into our lives. And it takes time. It takes time. It's not a week or month to go through a process, whether or not we're looking at a potential lover or permanent relationship, or whether or not we're really looking at potential friends, to find out who people are and who people are not. So again, the book is For Better, For Worse, Forever: Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And I'm also the new advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons. I'm really excited about that. People are starting to write in with various different questions, and I'm writing a column twice a month for Dan's paper. And if you do not have the hard copy available to you, you can just go to Dan's papers online and you can read all of my Ask Beatty articles. And I'm hoping you're going to enjoy them and that they will empower you and motivate you and inspire you again to do things that are really in your best interest. I'm also a national speaker, and I've been in national radio and television as an expert guest now for over 35 years. And every time I say that, it's like, I cannot even believe it. Where has 35 years actually gone? And of course, I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. I think I'm one of the lucky people that I have been very, very fortunate to have a career where I am as passionate about it today as I was when I finished my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill University in Montreal. So what is the Ask Beatty show all about? Well, in one word, my friends, it is about empowerment, and not just about empowerment for women. It is about empowerment for all of us. And what we do on the show is that we talk about all the things, and there are so many things that we can actually do, not just talk about, to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships. So naturally, we talk a lot about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships and how and what to do. Again, the key word here is do, to maximize our physical and our emotional well-being, despite the fact that we all go through a lot of ups and downs in our lives and that we all are dealing with stresses and stressors on a regular basis. But I have a mantra, and it's a mantra that I have tried, and I don't practice it perfectly. Of course, nobody does anything perfectly. I try to practice it every single day. And that mantra is to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can the things that get in the way of our being able to really live a happy and a joyful life. And what I hope is that I have convinced you over all of these years is that we don't need to take this journey on our own. And reaching out to family and friends, and if need be to professionals, can really make our life journey easier and less isolated and alienated and lonely. And a patient of mine, she had texted me something last week, and I thought it was like the perfect thing to share with you. And she says that a reminder to say no to the things, people, and places that steal our joy. Again, a reminder to say no, because, you know, sometimes we'll say no when we mean yes, and yes when we mean no. So it is, again, a reminder to say no to the things and people and places that steal our joy, regardless of whether or not they are family or friends or colleagues or anyone. And then I was thinking about my own father's philosophy of life, Morris Serre. He was my coach off and on the courts. We were very, very close. I was very lucky to have a father who was so tuned in to me on so many different levels. And my dad, he had a philosophy of never giving up, regardless of what the perils were and what the challenges were that were facing us. And I'm going to tell you a really cute story. I wasn't actually planning to talk about this, but this is one of the great things about doing radio and being on the Progressive Radio Network, is that we don't need to have a script, so we can be as spontaneous as we wish. Well, here it was. I was 12 years old. And my father was very active in my life, in my sports life. My mom, on the other hand, was a teacher, and she was very active in my academic life and was extremely upset that her daughter, Beatty, was really not a keen student. So here I am. It is 12 years old in Winnipeg, Canada, and that is where I was born. And it was late spring, and my dad and I, we were out on the tennis courts, and he had taught me to play tennis when I was a few years younger, probably began when I was maybe 9 or 10. So we were out, and I couldn't hit a ball. It was so frustrating. I remember it was a lovely day, and he was very, very patient. But, you know, one of those days. And for those of you who are in the world of sports, or really in the game of life, there are days that we are just not going to be able to do it, whatever it may be. So we decided after this unfortunate tennis game that we were going to go for lunch. And we went for lunch, and we were looking at the sports page. And we discovered that the Manitoba Junior Tennis Championship was starting that very afternoon. Now, you have to understand, I had never been in a tennis tournament in my life. I had competed in a variety of other sports, in badminton, and I was a figure skater. So I had decided during this lunch that I wanted to be in this tournament. Now, understanding, of course, that I could not hit a ball that particular morning. So my dad said, look, you know, the tournament began, the draw is done. And I convinced him that we should go to the park. And the name of the park, I still remember it, Sargent's Park in Winnipeg, Canada. And I don't know exactly how I did this, because I don't think I was the most confident child in the world. And I went up to somebody who was the tournament director, and I said, look, I just discovered that the tournament was beginning, and would there be any way that you could put me in the draw? And I remember that the lady said, little girl, you know, the draw was made several weeks ago, and, you know, maybe next year. Now, I'm not exactly sure what I said, but somehow, and my dad was not involved in this conversation, so somehow I convinced this woman. I mean, I had no name. Nobody knew anything about me. I mean, I was really a non-entity in the world of Manitoba Junior Tennis, that she should put me in the draw. Well, she did. And I will never forget this day for as long as I live. I went through the first round, and I went through the second round. I won. And here I am in the finals against a young girl who'd been playing for a long, long time. In fact, I remember her name too. Her name was Cynthia Stubbs. And it was just amazing. I couldn't miss the ball. My backhands, my forehands, my serve, my volley, everything was just really beyond, as I like to say. And needless to say, I won my first Manitoba Junior Tennis Championship. And, you know, I think about my dad's philosophy, and I think it's a philosophy that if we could all take in, of never, never giving up. Now, obviously, I needed to change my strategy from the earlier part of the day, since nothing was working when I was hitting with my dad in the morning. But, you know, we all go through so many challenging times in our lives. And it's really about figuring out when things are not going well. You know, what is it that we need to do? And I ask people every single week to, and I probably overdo it because I am constantly not only making evaluations of patients that I'm seeing, but also evaluating my own life and my own behavior as well. So I'm going to ask you these really four questions. And the first question, and I want you to be honest with yourself, because there's always good news and there's always ways to change your strategy. And there's always ways to do, you know, as we say in the entertainment business, you know, another take, a take two or a take three. So here are the questions. Am I happy with the quality of my relationships with my partner? If you're lucky enough to have a good partner, my children, my grandchildren, my friends and business associates, it takes some time to actually do this. And I ask my patients to really write it out or type it out so that you're then able to really read your answers. Number two. Am I satisfied with the state of my health emotionally, physically, spiritually, and sexually? You know, think about it. Am I happy with my relationships? Am I happy with my health? Am I living a financially responsible life? Because these days it is so easy to get caught up in all of these interest-free deals that we are constantly bombarded with. And so many people I know, they're overextending themselves with these multiple interest-free deals, you know, and get themselves into a lot of trouble. And number four, is how do I really feel about the overall quality of my life? So after doing your initial assessment or analysis, the real question is whether you're prepared to actually do something about any or all of these areas that require some homework, that require some attention or changes, because we can go on and on about how unhappy we are with our health or our body or our professions or our financial situations and just continue to lament the problem and whine and moan for the rest of our life. And I think that whining and moaning and expressing our feelings, it's all good. We've got to get it out. And there's no really better way to express feelings. Of course, you want to make sure that you're being constructive in the way you're expressing your feelings. But it's important to get the feelings out. But then we get to a point where we actually need to have a plan of action. Of what we can do to improve our relationships or our health or our financial situation. So in evaluating your personal relationships as an example, you may be one of the fortunate people whose relationships are primarily satisfying and happy. And you have to remember, if you're lucky enough to have great relationships, to continue to enjoy them and nurture them every single day. Because one thing for sure is at the end of our lives, we will realize that what really matters, it's not the big houses and the trips and the cars, but it is the quality of our relationships with the ones that we love. But on the other hand, you may be forced to admit to yourself that certain of these relationships are disappointing. And we all go through life where we are going to have some disappointing relationships. And maybe these relationships, they've been frustrating for a long time. Or at worst, they are destructive and self-destructive to you and to your very, very being. So now, okay, you're acknowledging it. Okay, these relationships, they're not so good. This is destructive. This is self-destructive. But now the real question is, are you going to actually do something? Are you finally prepared to tackle the various relationship problems or financial problems or health issues that you are experiencing one at a time? Because it can be like totally, totally overwhelming if you're planning to do everything at one time, which is really not possible. So you can prioritize. We all need to prioritize the things that we need to acknowledge and address and hopefully resolve. So one at a time, and hopefully you're going to be able, again, with or without help, attempt to make some positive changes that will ultimately impact the quality of your life. Or on the other hand, like many people, you may prefer, although you would deny that you're preferring this, you may prefer to just continue to complain and complain about the state of your life and do nothing. And everybody, of course, talks about New Year's resolutions. So I'm asking you, are you willing to make some positive New Year's resolutions? Of course, we don't need to wait for New Year to make changes in our life. And really do what is in your best interest. And if you are not sure what is in your best interest, because maybe like so many people that I have treated over the years who've been abused in a variety of different ways, feel some, in quotes, comfort in being in dysfunctional, destructive, and self-destructive relationships and are used to not being good to themselves, then again, you have an option to reach out and ask for help. And I understand, and I'm the first one to acknowledge that there are serious, serious problems and issues with American mental health, particularly in terms of access and also in terms of cost, so that we need to be very vigilant and creative. And as my dad used to say, to never really give up in trying to find resources, in trying to find people who can help us. Because when I look, and every single week, you know, I'm continually looking at statistics, depression statistics, divorce statistics, domestic violence statistics, actually hoping that the statistics are going to improve. But unfortunately, this week, there are still 17 million adults, and I think that number is low in the United States, who are suffering from clinical depression. 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And in the world of domestic violence, 4 women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. And this is despite the fact that we have all these self-help books and therapists and coaches and seminars and retreats and relationship programs. And we're continuing to not do well. But again, if we're talking about relationships, and I know that those of you who've been listening to the show, you have probably heard what I'm going to say ad nauseum, but it is worthwhile repeating. Because what I have discovered over the years is that there really are 3 things that we need to do to never make a mistake in love again. And the first thing is that we need to be in a good place. The relationship really does need to be the icing on the cake. And we really do need to be the cake. And we really do need to be solid. And we really do need to be willing to deal with our own unfinished business and our skeletons in the closet, regardless of what those issues are and regardless of when those issues actually came about. And of course, most people that I treat, the issues began in the beginning with their own family of origin, with mom and dad, if they grew up in a family where there was a mom and a dad. And listen carefully. Even though we cannot change our histories, okay? We can't change anything that's happened even a second ago. What we can do, if we are willing and able, and if you're able to, you know, find some good help, and there are some good people around, I mean, there are, to be able to emotionally process the things that are getting in the way of your life, whether or not they are historical things or whether or not there are things currently that are going on that are contributing to your depression, to your anxiety, to your being in toxic, dysfunctional kinds of relationships. So we need to get ourselves in a good place. And again, when we're talking about relationships, we need to figure out. We need to figure out the ingredients that actually do go into a successful relationship. And number three, it's not because I wrote the book. It's not because I did the research, but the assessment process that you go through when you read my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, it educates, it inspires, and above all, it keeps us safe. And, you know, yesterday, and this is an aside, I was talking to one of my patients. We had a therapy session. And yes, I do therapy on the weekends. And I do talk to people and do therapy frequently in the evening time as well. And this is a beautiful, beautiful young woman. She has an MBA from Stanford. She's got a great job. She's just a terrific, terrific young woman. And she's in what I consider to be a pretty toxic relationship. So she read my book and we went through everything. We went through how he treats her and he doesn't treat her very well and how there's little, if any, emotional intimacy. And I'm not talking about sex. Of course, you can have great sex without having any emotional intimacy, which is caring and sharing and respect and putting the relationship at the top of the list of priorities. So she read the book and she said, oh, Beattie, I love the book. The book is so great. But she said to me at the end of all of this, actually, it was at the end of yesterday's session, but I love him. I love him. When I'm feeling bad, you know, we cook together. And I said, that's great that he is able to cook you your favorite foods when you are feeling down. But the communication is basically non-existent. The problem-solving skills that this young man and this young woman have are just negligible. And the list goes on and on that this is not a relationship. This is not a healthy relationship for her. And yet she says, I love him. And I was trying to convince her. And of course, this is actually a relatively new patient that I'm working with, that feelings are great. Feelings of love and chemistry. I mean, they're delicious. But the feelings in themselves, those are not the things that are going to make a relationship work long term. It is the behavior. And as I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she first started dating, it's not what people say. People can tell you they love you and you're wonderful and you're terrific and you're smart and I care about you. The words are nice. We like to hear really nice words, right? We do. But it is not what you say. It is what you do. It is what people do. It is not the promises they make. It is whether or not they take the steps to make those promises come about. So needless to say, my young patient and I, we have some more work to do. And she's actually, you know, really afraid to leave this relationship. And it's interesting because this is a young woman who absolutely has everything going for her. And yet, I think she's really conflicted because she feels that these feelings, which she defines as love, are sufficient. And of course, they are not. Another statistic, and I was looking at this statistic just before the show began today, which really, really concerns me. And this is according to CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, that suicide was the second leading cause of death for people, young people between the ages of 13 to 19. I mean, when you think about it, that is amazing. When you're 13 and you're starting your teens and you're in your early teens and mid-teens, should this not be a time of fun? Of course, there are a lot of changes emotionally, physically,
specifically psychologically, but it is the second leading cause of death in the United States. And this next statistic really, really, really was shocking, that the leading cause of death, the leading cause of death amongst 13-year-old kids happens to be suicide. And looking at these numbers, of course, you know, the real question is what to do. So we have the knowledge. We have the results of a variety of different studies. And it's clear to me that, you know, parents, we need to be very, very vigilant in understanding that this is an extremely tender, tender age. You know, we think of our 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, and we're monitoring them and we're helicopter parenting them. But, you know, these numbers, they're very, very, very concerning. And this is where I think, again, you've heard me say this many, many times, that I think that the school has a major, major role in being able to not only identify, but be able to ideally prevent, you know, kids who are in a very, very bad place from making gestures or, at worst, killing themselves. And I know that the schools and teachers, everybody is overwhelmed. We're overwhelmed with tests and curriculum and educational standards. And yet the mental health issues of students, and I think that we're talking more and more and more these days about mental health. We're seeing athletes come out and talk about it. And I think that maybe we can even make mental health and mental health issues something that is actually cool, because years and years ago, as you know, it was something that was really in the closet. I mean, nobody would talk about their depression, or if they had somebody in their family who was suicidal or depressed or had panic attacks or who had been hospitalized. But again, I think that schools, and I wonder really what schools around the country, I have not been connected with the school system in a number of years, are talking about what teachers and principals and guidance counselors are actually talking about, and I hope that they are aware of these statistics. I mean, I've always believed, as one of the directors, the old directors of the school social services program in Greater Montreal, that early identification, we were able to put together pupil personnel teams where if the teacher had any inclination at all that the child was either depressed or sad or angry or was missing too much school, that there would be a referral made to a school social worker, and there would be team meetings where we would have the guidance counselor and the psychologists and the teachers to really try to make sure that there was no child that was left behind. And I think that this really needs to be the protocol in elementary school, the junior high schools, and high schools around the country. And so if any of you know, if you're teachers or principals or guidance counselors, I'd be very, very curious to hear about what is going on in your school system, because clearly these numbers are very, 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 very alarming. Well, I have some other articles that I actually wanted to speak with you about, articles from the New York Times. And this was an article from a couple of days ago, and that is why 6 to 8 hours of sleep at night is crucial. And finding that slumber sweet spot can help fend off various mental and physical ills. So sleep, as we know, both in its quantity and its quality, is one of the most frequently discussed health topics. You know, how often have you told a friend, I'm exhausted, I was up half the night? Yes, I was also actually up half the night last night. I found that the sheets that we were sleeping on were irritating me. So I was telling Jim that we need to get rid of some cotton sheets. But anyways, that's just really an aside. Surveys have found that more than a third of American adults are unable to consistently get a good night's sleep, with millions having trouble falling asleep. And the pandemic seems to have only made things worse, even for those who were previously in, quote, good sleepers. So remote work gave many people more hours in the day for personal use. But at the same time, when you think about it, you know, how many people are on their phones and on their computers 24/7, you know, with the text and the Zoom calls. So our systems were really taken into a place that was not in our best interest in all kinds of ways, but certainly when it came to sleep. And the real thing is that there is growing evidence that indicates that disrupted or insufficient sleep can have widespread damaging effects on our physical and mental well-being. Because sleep deprivation, it increases the risk of developing, and I didn't know this, heart disease. You think about it, you're not getting enough sleep. And look at how you are putting your body at risk. So there is a risk of developing heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, and type 2 diabetes. So, for example, too, a major study suggests that middle-aged people who are chronically short on their sleep have an increased risk. Again, this was a new finding that I didn't know, of developing dementia in their later years, and that those of us, I try very hard to get a lot of sleep, those who sleep significantly more than 7 hours a night, and this was interesting too, however, are not necessarily spared sleep-related health risks. Because sleep-deprived people have more accidents and are more likely to fall asleep at inappropriate times, like at play or concerts, or most seriously, while driving. But again, they were saying that the optimal health, it's not 10 hours or 12 hours, for optimal health, according to these studies, there seems to be a sweet spot of 6 to 8 hours of nightly sleep. This is a 6-year study of more than a million adults ages 30 to 102. So that's a pretty valid, reliable study by researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and the American Cancer Society, revealed a U-shaped curve with the highest mortality rates among those who slept more, that's so interesting, than 8 hours. So sleeping more than 8 hours isn't good, or less than 4 hours a night. Okay, so we understand the problem. So what to do? So fostering a good night's sleep. This is what these researchers suggest. Okay, avoid all sources of caffeine in the late afternoon and evening, as well as a big, heavy meal close to bedtime. Because I know that when I lived in Israel, the big, heavy meal was at lunch, and we had very light dairy, light meals in the evening for dinner. So avoiding heavy meals and avoiding caffeine in the late afternoon and evening. Practicing good sleep hygiene. Go to bed and get up at about the same time every single day. Do not use alcohol to help you unwind. Try a warm bath or meditation, which I think is always a great thing to do. And reading before bed is great, as long as it's not on a computer. That's interesting. So we can read books as long as it is not on a computer or tablet that emits sleep-inhibiting light. And I didn't know that as well. Hadn't even thought about that. So if outside light impedes sleep, install light-blocking shades. And if noise is a problem, use earplugs. I have worn earplugs for most of my life. And these are some of the tips that can actually help you have a better night's sleep. Okay, so again, there are a lot of things that we can actually, do. And there was another piece here in the New York Times, the title, Physical Activity and Aging Brains. And we talk about this a lot, the importance. For example, simply walking increases the immune cells that may help keep our memory sharp. So there was a study, I'm going to just briefly go through a couple of studies here. The study which tracked how often older people moved or sat and then looked deep inside their brains after they died found that certain vital immune cells worked differently in the brains of older people who were active compared to their more sedentary peers. So physical activity seemed to influence our brain's health. And the other thing that I think is so interesting is that older sedentary people who begin walking for about an hour most days, for instance, typically add volume to their hippocampus, which is the brain's memory center, reducing or reversing the shrinkage that otherwise commonly occurs there over the years. And active people who are middle-aged or older also tend to perform better on tests of memory and thinking than people of the same age who rarely exercise. So what these findings suggest, okay, and we talk about the importance over and over again of exercise, is that physical activity may delay or alter memory loss from Alzheimer's disease. I find it's a great antidepressant exercise. It is a great, great anti-anxiety. And it is not a bad thing that we can look in the mirror and that we can actually be proud of our bodies and all of the different things that we are doing, not just thinking about, are doing to keep our bodies really healthy. But then there was another article that I read that I really wanted to also share with you. And this article, Four Lifestyle Habits the Longest Lived People on the Planet All Have in Common. I don't know about you. I want to live to 1,000. I want to feel healthy. I want to look healthy. I want to be mentally sharp. So when it comes to designing a wellness routine, decision fatigue is all too common. There are loads of workouts and mental health practices and eating plans to choose from, all with their own corresponding benefits. But for anyone wishing to the best practices of the longest and healthiest living people on the planet, all right, there are four longevity lifestyle habits that truly move the needle when it comes to fighting disease. According to Dean Hornish, we all know about Dr. Dean Hornish, MD, and his wife, Anne Hornish, and they are a couple who research and write about behaviors that improve chronic diseases like diabetes. And they're sharing some of their findings. They have a new book on Do It with Hornish, where they explain that many illnesses, and Gary Nell talks about this a lot, including inflammation and oxidative stress, which is an interruption in the natural balance of free radicals and antioxidants in our system, and changes to your microbiome originate from the same sources. And they have found that most of these biological concerns can be traced back to four key lifestyle habits. So I am going to get on and I'm going to tell you exactly what they are. So the four longevity lifestyle habits that promote disease prevention are, number one, they eat plant-based diets. So when it comes to filling their plates, the folks of the Blue Zones focus on plants. They're eating 90 to 100% plant-based food beyond a shadow of a doubt. So foods like, we're talking about vegetables and fruits and grains and benefits, they benefit our heart, Our gut and our brain, plus plant-based diets, are associated with a lower risk of heart disease, prevention of type 2 diabetes, a reduced risk of cancer, and the prevention of Alzheimer's, and the list goes on and on. So here we have some research, bona fide research that has been done over, you know, a number of different years. So again, my question to you, knowing this, knowing about the importance of having a plant-based diet, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to put away your bacon? Are you going to stop buying steaks? Or are you going to maybe consider what researchers are finding about the importance of plant-based diets? Okay, number two. And I thought this was really interesting. They manage stress by gardening. Researchers are really just beginning to understand how stress contributes to disease, but early findings indicate that the mental turmoil caused by a too long to-do list or one too many nights of poor sleep essentially compromises our body's ability to regulate inflammation. And scientists now believe that this can cause diseases like Alzheimer's to both develop and progress, hence why stress management is a huge part of protecting your body and mind from disease. Gardening, and if you're not into gardening, I guess it's about finding other kinds of activities, incorporating other kinds of behaviors that will help you to de-stress. Number three, of course, physical activity. So important. The research is absolutely clear that, for example, just walking to the grocery store or dancing or practicing Tai Chi or riding a bike can basically help to lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. So you don't have to run marathons. It's just about keeping really active. And number four, of course, which is something that, you know, I talk about a lot, is that these people, they stay closely connected to their communities. Having people, not just any people, by the way, having good people and eliminating toxicity, including toxic people from your life who love and care for you and who you love and care for in return is not only good for us, it is good for our bodies. And love, when you think about it, it is not something that you hear about often in mainstream medicine. And that's the part that the Ornish's participants are most apprehensive about, even though it's probably the most valuable. And one study, according to the Ornish's, demonstrated that dementia risk in people above the age of 75 was lowest for those who had various satisfying social connections. So, you know, it comes down to the importance of making sure that we have a lot of positivity, positive, loving people in our life, and that we do, even though it is unpleasant, that we make sure that we eliminate, that we get rid of, and I'm not talking about killing or shooting anybody, I'm talking about eliminating toxic people in our life, whether or not it is family, whether or not it happened to be friends or business associates. And as I say to my patients all the time, a little bit of poison can kill you. So people will make excuses. Well, he's only abusive on an occasional basis, or, you know, she's only miserable and puts me down, you know, from time to time. From time to time is also not okay. And I think that what we need to do, my friends, is to really give ourselves permission to really avoid contact And sometimes that means avoiding total contact from people who are poisonous to us, even if, you know, in quotes, there is just a little bit of poison on occasion. So we're talking again about doing things that are in our best interest, eating well, sleeping, taking naps, exercise, having supportive people, eliminating toxicity, chemicals, and people. The importance of positive visualization and dancing and listening to music. And what I have found also, you know, with the holiday time approaching, there are a lot of people, and there was another article here in the New York Times a couple of days ago, must I go home for the holidays? Well, the answer is not these days. And a lot of people, and I think more and more people, are feeling liberated by the loss of tradition over the past 2 years. I think that we've gotten very, very used to Zooming, and there are a lot of options now. I mean, just think, you could be on a computer, you can be on your phone, you can be on an iPad, and you can still have those connections to people. But this article talked a little bit about not only how difficult it is these days with travel and continuing concerns about the pandemic. But if you're going to be going home, if you're thinking about going home for Christmas or any other holiday or visiting your family, and if the family is basically toxic, and if you have a terrible, terrible time and you end up feeling worse, you know, after you've been there, I mean, you really may consider some other options. And this article says is that people across the country are saying no more to, in quotes, holiday obligations. And we're finally realizing that we don't have to do things in the way that they've always been. And throughout the pandemic, many Americans have realized the value in taking care of themselves and doing what they want. And some people might say, well, that's really, really selfish. But again, we have to think about, you know, is it worthwhile going on planes and running around airports when there is still the concern about the pandemic? And do we really want to go and visit friends and family where we end up having a terrible, terrible time? And I think that that's kind of the takeaway, is that we don't have to do things the way that we've always done them, especially if we are discovering more and more that it is not in our best interest to do it. And a lot of people are finding that the pandemic also turned friends into family. So when they couldn't be with their biological relatives, some created a family of friends and neighbors who lived, you know, closer. And for some people, and this is a quote from this article, what the pandemic has taught me is that family doesn't have to represent those that are blood relatives, that family is made of those people who support you and love you. So when I think about who I want to spend the holidays with, it's with those people, whether or not they actually are my blood relatives or not. I'm so curious, you know, what you might think about that, whether or not for many of you, it is a relief to not be traveling and spending time with your family, even though it may have been a tradition. And of course, for, you know, those people who are lucky enough to have great family who they love to spend time with, who they love to have wonderful discussions and eat and share wonderful food with. I mean, I think that that's something, you know, that is quite different. But I think that for a lot of people, it has felt, and it still probably feels like, in quotes, an obligation. And with so many people that I see in my private practice here in New York and also in East Hampton, the time spent with family. You know, you're looking forward to maybe this year is going to be a better celebratory year than last year. But a lot of people that I talk to, they actually dread getting together. And I think that looking at other options, I mean, I found too that I never ever dreamed that I would feel relatively comfortable with doing psychotherapy on Zoom. And yet about 80% of the people that I'm still seeing are actually, even people who are living in New York, are still preferring to do the sessions on Zoom. Now, again, no question that seeing patients, in person, at least in my particular way of practicing, is certainly better, but it is okay enough, and sometimes okay enough just needs to be what we are going to be dealing with. So maybe Zooming and FaceTiming and emailing and texting may be something that you want to consider doing this year. You can reevaluate it certainly next year. Instead of, traveling miles and miles away to see people where the probability of being able to really enjoy yourself is virtually low. Again, thinking about as you're navigating your days, here we are, we're coming full circle on the show today, thinking about, are the behaviors, are the people, are the relationships, are these in my best interest? Or even though it's holiday time, am I engaging in interactions with people? And we can add including travel to this list in ways that are either destructive or self-destructive or self-sabotaging. So, what I hope every single week here on the Ask BD Show is that I get you to think about some of these issues. I mean, I certainly don't have all the answers for each of you. I mean, those are things that we all have to really figure out for ourselves. But that's what I hope, and that's what I've always hoped when I've been doing the radio shows here on the Progressive Radio Network, and when I appear as an expert guest on television shows, is that I leave you with some things to ponder, points to ponder. So everybody, now we're here. It's 3:57 Eastern Standard Time here in New York. I'm going to leave you with my two weekly messages. And the first, of course, is to do everything that you can possibly do to be living your life in ways that are in your best interest. And that means loving yourself, taking care of yourself emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And of course, the second message, and this is what we all need to do a much, much, much better job in our society, is to find much better ways to love each other. So I hope that this has been a helpful and enjoyable show where you have some things to actually think about that you will hopefully then be able to put into action. So I wish you all a happy holiday. I'm planning to be hosting the Ask BD Show for the next 2 weeks so that we will be able to end 2021. I don't think I've actually missed a week. That's 52 Ask BD shows in the past year. But I really do. I love doing this show. I love hearing from you. And most of all, I love educating and empowering you with knowledge and advice that can really help you live a happier and more joyful life. So have a really, really good rest of the day, and I will talk with you next week. Goodbye, everybody. Take care. Bye.